record this meeting for minutes. And I want to thank everybody so much for coming. I know July is typically not the most well-attended meeting that we have throughout the year. So thank you all for your dedication during the summer. I really appreciate it. Today we have a special sector spotlight. We're welcoming Steve Davenport from the Chatham Emergency Squad, and I'll let him introduce himself. But just a couple things before we get started that I want to make sure that I mention for anybody that might have to pop off early. Our next meeting is going to be a combined meeting. We do two combined meetings over the course of the year with MAC and MASA. So this next meeting in August will be a combined meeting. It's going to be August 18th, which is a Wednesday, and we're going to do it at 10 a.m. We're going to try to do it in person. We're looking for a location right now. So if anybody has any ideas, please let myself or Sarah Jacob or Amy Lewis know. And we will be meeting on Friday of this week to talk about what we're going to be focusing on for that meeting. But we chose the August meeting because of Fishawak and Bottle Hill Day that are coming up, which are, as everyone knows, huge community festivals, great tabling opportunities for our organizations. So we want to make sure that we have, you know, there's no duplication at our tables, that we're all sort of focusing on different topics around substance use prevention. So we're going to be doing that. And then we're also going to have, hopefully have a guest speaker as well. I think that we decided we want the focus to be around cannabis. So we're going to meet on Friday and hopefully nail all of that down. But again, it's Wednesday, August 18th at 10 a.m. and meeting location we'll let you know about. But other than that, I'm going to go ahead and go right into our sector spotlight. So as you all know, we started doing sector spotlights 2 years ago now, maybe. We've had some really great people from the groups from the community come in and share a little bit about what they do and how MCC might be able to provide resources or partner with that organization. And it's such a great opportunity for us as coalition members to learn about all of these wonderful organizations and groups that we have in Madison and Chatham. So as I said, today we have Steve Davenport, who is the president of the Chatham Emergency Squad. And we are so happy and grateful that he is here with us. So I'm gonna go ahead and turn it over to Steve. We will have time for questions, you know, at the end of what he shares. So if you have anything comes into your mind, jot it down and we'll answer those questions. So Steve, it's all yours. We can't hear you. Can everyone hear him? Anybody hear him?
No.
No.
1 minute, I was able to read that lip. I had a Zoom call last night, and when I got on, this was after joint meeting, John, my computer decided to do Microsoft updates. And I couldn't get around it. It was like, so I missed the call.
I don't know if you still can hear us.
He's trying something. Steve, you might want to try to go out and come back in. I've had that before and that resolves a little sound problem.
Or try the opposite. Somebody else had a problem where they shut it off and it worked. No?
Yeah, but if you try to reboot, is that what you mean, Stacy? Reboot?
No, actually, I was in a meeting and for some reason, whatever the connectivity was, it showed that they were on mute and they actually were able to talk. So,
oh,
it'd be dangerous.
The opposite.
Strange technology, yeah. Maybe there was some double negative going on in their system.
Yeah, technology is wonderful when it works.
Exactly.
For those of you that had power outages yesterday late, half of Chatham and most of Summit, it was a tree that fell in a 10-mile-an-hour wind and took down two utility poles on Watchung Avenue. Steve, try going, leave the call and come back in. I don't know if you could hear me.
Is he on his iPhone?
No, it doesn't look that way because the iPhone usually you'd have like the...
Because I've had a problem with the iPhone where I could hear everybody, but I wasn't able to contribute in. I haven't figured that out.
Do you know if he can hear us, Allison? Yeah, he can.
So okay, maybe, sure.
Maybe yeah. try to leave the meeting and come back in.
Yeah, leave the meeting and come back in.
We'll do something else in the meantime. We'll do something else on the agenda and have you come back. I want to be on your charades team. All right. We'll go ahead and start with. I'll go into just some quick updates, and then Nixie has some updates, and hopefully by that time, Steve will be able to speak to us. We'll be able to hear him. So just a couple of updates for MCC. Kiana and I met with some of our new Teen Task Force members. Kiana's on vacation this week, so she couldn't join us today. But last week we met with four new Teen Task Force members, and we're so excited. They are awesome. They're so good. They are actually two of them are siblings of our past Teen Task Force members. And it's so funny, they're all girls right now from Chatham, sophomores and juniors. And we talked about a short-term goal, an intermediate and a long-term goal, just to kind of get us started. We've already established a new Instagram account for the Teen Task Force. It's MCC Teen Task Force. So give that a follow. It's going to be led completely by them. They're going to operate that account, and we'll be sure to be reposting everything on our main Instagram account as well. They're going to be doing an Instagram takeover next week, actually, where they introduce themselves, they share a little bit about themselves and why they're part of the Teen Task Force. So that was our short-term goal. Our intermediate goal, they're actually going to be doing, at our last meeting, I talked about environmental scans, which is it's a initiative or it's a thing that we do as a coalition to collect data in our communities. That focuses on substance use. So, you know, at one of our meetings, Len mentioned a specific area in Chatham that he had noticed there was a lot of vaping cartridges and things like that. So that's a location that these teens will go to. They'll collect different data. They'll fill out a questionnaire, and then we'll compile that data as part of our community needs assessment.
We found another congregation point, unfortunately, that a resident called me on yesterday, and that was down at the Passaic River Trail at Shepherd Colic Park.
Okay.
So there's an area where you can take your dog and the dog can go in the river, but the caller identified and DPW went down there and cleaned up, used condoms, vaping paraphernalia, marijuana, all kinds of beer cans, beer bottles, and a bottle of Jack Daniels. So that was all cleaned up. So these kids are getting out there.
Yeah. So the goal with going to these areas and collecting this data is, you know, the ultimate goal would be that there's increased police presence or at least party patrol, that type of intervention, but also potentially signage that we would create and pay for. So, based on what the substance, you know, the garbage that's found is. But
yeah, we're considering whether to mount a motion sensored camera with a light so that if somebody's there late at night, then, you know, we can see who it is, because that area is like pitch black. You absolutely have to have a flashlight to go down here right at night. But they're down there. I mean, it's just it's, I mean, I understand teens are going to do what they do, but it's pretty disgraceful to find that much. I mean, it was a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, with the teen task force as well, where, you know, we're going to start with one or two locations and sort of fairly public, you know, as visible locations as possible, just to get them started. All of the data that they're going to be collecting is going to be online. So they'll be able to do it right on their phone and then submit it. And it goes right to Epiphany compiles everything, our data contractor. So they'll be able to compile all of it. And then it's just great. We'll be able to use it for the needs assessment. But the ultimate goal is to have the teen task force be the ones that get in front of town councils and in front of police to share this information. One of the goals that Kiana and I have for the teen task force right now is really, really have it be totally teen driven, which it really was before, but this time, you know, really letting them be responsible for all aspects of it and just have Kiana and myself be the facilitators of the activities. So
can I ask a question? Will this task force be talking to the council and the police beforehand on what they will be doing? And will they be meeting with them to, you know, let them know that the data will be submitted to Epiphany and then they will go to the council and the police? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, typically they would do that after. If they go to location and find, you know, what Len is saying, Epiphany would be able to, they would have to quantify what they're finding and do things like that. And then Epiphany would be able to help with what information is actually presented to town councils.
But what I'm saying is, would they go to the council and the police beforehand to let them know, here's what we're doing? That's what I'm asking.
That we hadn't planned to do it that way, but we certainly could, just to let them know, or, you know, at least let a representative from the councils know. So we have Len and Stacy here, or council and committee. So that's definitely something that we can do also, and inform law enforcement as well. I think in some locations it might be nice to have law enforcement there when we're actually doing the scan, if possible, depending on the location. Just so that they're part of that process.
Because there's still the juvenile police working also. So I think that would be a good for them, just to add input or vice versa type thing, you know, at the get-go.
Yeah, and for them to be able to see it themselves as well.
I think if we do what Lisa suggests, the word gets out that, hey, we're aware of it, we're watching you, and maybe that helps to deter. Anyway, Steve is back.
Yes. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Allison. Feel free to slap it in wherever it suits your agenda.
We can hear you.
Good to hear your voice.
Most people think it's a bonus when I am permanently muted.
No, you have a radio.
Not me.
All right, I apologize for that. I had to reload the drivers that was my son's laptop. And I'm pretty sure that I have to reset the antivirus software to allow access, but we'll troubleshoot it another day.
There you go.
Well, welcome. We're happy to have you. We will we'll stop where we were and come back to it so we can just jump right into your part.
Well, thanks for including the squad in your meeting today. Congratulations to you, Stacy. There is a need and a tradition that when we have new mayors, we need to sit down and give you a full briefing about the condition of the squad. The Chatham Emergency Squad is a private, not-for-profit corporation. We are independent of the borough and the township, which we serve both of those municipalities. But we're as proud as we are of our independence. We're every bit as proud of the extremely close alliance that we share with those two municipal governments, their police departments, their fire departments, their DPWs. We rely on them heavily. So I'll look forward, Stacy, to giving you a good report about the condition of the squad.
Well, thank you,
you'll never have to give me a briefing because I'll never be mayor.
No, but thank you, Steve. You guys, I've had to use the emergency squad over the years, and it's truly a Chatham treasure to have you guys
Amen.
In place where, you know, it's helping out.
Well, thanks for saying that. Allison, have you had an opportunity to have the Madison squad be with
no.
the Alliance?
So we were scheduled to have the Madison squad for our April or March 20th, 2020 meeting. And that was canceled and we just haven't been able to reconnect. So not yet.
Good. So I'm not an expert in the Madison squad, but much of our approach, much of our corporate structure, much of our dispatching, the things I'm going to say, I think when they do have an opportunity to present, will be consistent, that we are, we're cut very much from the same cloth. So I'll give you the broad strokes about who we are, and then you can ask me anything you'd like to know that may be more germane to the work of the Alliance. As I said, we are a not-for-profit. The key things that I need for members of the Alliance and for the community to understand is that we are all volunteer. Today, we have 90 members. Almost all of them are EMTs, and the few auxiliary members that we have by and large retired from serving as emergency medical technicians. That is our the designation of the members of the squad who take 911 calls or EMTs, emergency medical technicians. That is a certification that is nationally recognized and then accepted by the state. So I am certified by the state of New Jersey to perform within my scope of practice. Earning that certification is much more difficult than when they foolishly allowed me to have it. And that is about 200 hours in the classroom, plus another roughly 40 hours of practical writing time. On the Chatham squad, developing into a full member, we use the term certified member, requires the achievement of that state certification, plus our standards are considerably more rigorous. We have lots of other training requirements before we will grant full certified status to a member. What basically we want is for you not to, just have the training, but we want you to demonstrate the requisite skill, knowledge, and maturity in the field before we give you our full stamp of approval. What is special about being a certified member is that you can be alone with a patient. Otherwise, when the Chatham squad responds to a call, the first person that will make patient contact from the squad will always be a fully certified member, and then the rest of us will arrive. Also, it's important to know that we never charge for our services. The Chatham Emergency Squad does not bill its patients. We're in our 85th year of existence, and we have never charged a dime of anyone that we have served. And our plan is to keep it that way. There are some advantages that we gain in terms of statutory indemnifications from not being fee for service. But the most important thing about not charging for our services is no one in our community needs to hesitate to dial 911. We're going to bring A-plus care to anyone who dials 911, whether or not they're a Chatham resident. And it's never a consideration for us anyone's insurance status or ability to pay. Those are the two big things. We're all volunteer. We never charge. And we need for the community to understand that. Why do we need them to understand it? It's because you can't volunteer for something you don't know is volunteer. I would suspect that I know for a fact that is not well understood by a large number of the adults in the Chathams, that we are a volunteer organization. It's quite frankly something that's not appreciated until game day when one of our patients used the phrase with us recently and it's resonated. You don't know how much you need them until you need them. And so there's not great cause for us to be a part of the consciousness of the community, right up until you or your next door neighbor has dialed and the ambulance is parked outside. So even people who are highly engaged in the community are surprised to hear about that. And Stacy, you are given an advantage here because I have sat down more than once with newly elected mayors who were not clear on our status. So how does it all work? If anyone dials 911 from either a cell phone that pings off a local tower or using a landline, and I'm happy to talk about any of this in detail about how the Morris County Communications Center knows where the call is originating from and how 911 works. Two things happen simultaneously if they describe a medical emergency. They happen at exactly the same moment that the police are dispatched to that scene and the squad is dispatched to that scene. One of the nice things about being an EMT almost anywhere in Morris County is that we are always accompanied by the police. Sometimes we arrive before them. On rare occasions, they don't have that sufficient manpower to meet every challenge in town. And if there's if there are three patrolmen on duty and there are four emergency calls simultaneously, and there's no reason to suspect that there's violence or instability in the scene, our police may choose not to ride with us, but that's okay. The overwhelming majority, we have them. Why is that important? One, gives us a sense of security. It almost always means there are one or two other healthy people to help us lift and carry. But our police officers in Chatham, and the same is true of our officers in Madison, are all experienced medical responders. I'm approaching my 20th year as an EMT on the Chatham squad and have served in any number of capacities, including captain a few times. And I have been on thousands of 911 calls. But if you have been a patrolman or patrolwoman for 7 or 8 years, you've been on multiples of that because they respond to every call. So not only do they bring their skill and their first responder status, it is not part of a police officer's job to be an emergency medical technician. Some are, but they are well-trained and experienced first responders. So they'll get their hands on a patient and they'll begin with basic interventions, medical interventions. Obviously, if there's some suspicion of violence or criminality, they'll also make a police intervention. They have with them oxygen bottles, AEDs, and other basic requirements for life saving. So in the trunk of that patrol car are some really important tools. How does the Chatham squad take advantage of that? Because we obviously have fully stocked ambulances that carry every last toy that is within our scope of practice. Our membership, we all carry pagers and cell phones. So when that 911 calls, or let me go back a half step, when that 911 calls, and if this is just way too basic and not interesting, somebody raise your hand and say something catchy like, Steve, be quiet. So when that 911 call is received, the dispatch goes out to the Chatham squad because it's in our area of responsibility, which is the borough and the township. And we carry pagers that are on our belt. They vibrate, they make squawky noise, they give us the information about the patient, where we're headed. We also simultaneously get texts. We have an app on our phone that will that also receives that information and have some other nifty tools. So that's how we know we're going to an emergency call. Every day of the year, 24/7, every day, there is a Chatham Emergency Squad duty crew on duty. And they have taken a blood oath to respond to a 911 call. It's the core responsibility of membership. So the pager goes off. We know which 3, 4, or 5 of our members are going to respond to that call because it's their regular 12-hour shift of the week. Should the duty crew be deployed, meaning they're out on the first call, then the dispatcher knows that. They use actually a different set of tones that come over the pager to alert our members that the duty crew is occupied, there's a medical emergency, and that we should respond. We call it, there's lots of names for that, scramble, duty crew out, catch all. So then available members, anyone who's available, and available means close enough to respond, probably wearing long pants or can get long pants on soon, is not in a bar. So they will take that second call. And one of the things that we are especially proud of on the Chatham squad is that we can take, we are well-staffed enough and present enough in the community that we have not failed to take a third simultaneous emergency call in many years. So that's how we know who's going. If I'm on duty right now, my crew is actually on a medical call on in Chatham Township. If while they're deployed, the pager goes off, members are alerted and they are connected by radios, which are now in push-to-talk devices, and they'll coordinate the response. And the conversation will be something like, I'm really close to the borough building. The Chatham squad operates two facilities. We have three ambulances. They'll say something like, I'm really close to the borough building. Why don't I get the ambulance? And the other responding members will say, yeah, I'm just around the corner from the patient. Let me go get my hands on the patient. And then it will come together, and typically never fewer than two certified members, but there could be as many as five or six members if it's a multiple vehicle accident, and that's reported over our airway, you'll see an even more fulsome response. So that's how we know we've got to get to sick and injured people. We may, and let me tie that back to my comment about the patrol persons. So if I am area responding, or I'm just a member going directly to the scene in my personal vehicle, I know that I may carry a modicum of medical supplies in my car. Most of us have jump kits. But I know there's going to be a patrolman immediately on scene, and that patrolman is going to have oxygen and an AED, and they're going to have airway adjuncts. So the basic life stabilization activities that I'm trained to provide, I can do as long as that patrol car rocks up with me. And then the ambulance and my fellow members will arrive in due course. Any questions so far? Allison, is this interesting, or am I just giving EMS 101 and everybody's like, enough?
No, I think it's wonderful.
I think it's really interesting. I didn't know like the logistics of how this worked. So this is, I'm finding it very interesting.
I guess I, in terms of questions, I would be interested in hearing, because this group is focused on, you know, 12 to 18, marijuana, you know, drug use, alcohol use, that type of thing, what, you know, any trends you're seeing, but also with COVID, I guess, I know you guys really had to put a lot of steps in, but how that either complicated your lives or what trends you were seeing as a result of that. So both those areas, I'd be interested in hearing more about.
Glad to. So I'll start out with COVID. And we are not released from COVID yet, as you might suspect. It was the Chatham squad got very serious about COVID in the first week of March last year. I happened to be captain at the time. And we came into it quite well prepared because we had taken Ebola so seriously. We were one of the few emergency squads in the state that resolved to provide its own Ebola response. And while that did not happen, it put us in a position that we were equipped. We had thought about decontamination. We had thought about body isolation. We had thought about issues of how can we expose the fewest of us to a patient? How can we decontaminate? So we were not on that footing, but we had a frame of reference and we got to it very quickly. Much of what we had to achieve was novel to us. And really what it was is it came back to Stacy doing less, where we would not send out full crews. We would send out very limited crews, two people with a third on standby. We would wear Tyvek anytime we had a suspicion. We would wear Tyvek to enter even certain kinds of facilities. And we got a collective experience and became quite adept at keeping ourselves safe. It was never contemplated by the Chatham Squad, as was the case and still is the case with some of our sister organizations in Morris County. It never occurred to us that we wouldn't take those calls. It just, we just say, okay, we've got 12 hours of learning to do for the 12 who are on, or the folks who are on, and we rolled through it. It was rigorous, it was frightening, but we fell into a groove with it, and we're not out of that groove. We still in a COVID, so we did improve our overall protocols for, especially for isolation and decontamination, and those will be a healthy legacy of COVID for the squad. Here's what you may find interesting about COVID is, especially from March until July, there was a real reluctance on the part of the community to seek medical care for things that on a sunny day, they would normally. So people were ignoring chest pains. People were ignoring dyspepsia, shortness of breath, and becoming sicker because they were so reluctant. They were so concerned about what may happen if they need to go to the hospital. There definitely was COVID at the hospital. There wasn't COVID at home. People didn't want to go. It for a period of say 10 to 12 weeks had a very dampening effect on the pace of our calls. So while we were taking COVID calls, which were intense, we were seeing less of those other calls. And it's not because people were not having chest pains. It's not because people didn't have asthma. It's not because people were not struggling with their alcoholism or weren't suspecting that their child had abused some kind of drug. They just didn't want to pack up and go to the hospital. So that, I believe, that became less of a phenomenon towards the end of 2020, and I don't believe factors at all today, in part because Morris County and our environs have been relatively more successful than other communities in other states and becoming immunized and making COVID less of a factor. Stacey, you also asked about trends in substance abuse, especially amongst younger people. The Chatham Emergency Squad, one of our organizing principles is the privacy of our patients. So for instance, my crew is out on a call. Even as the president, as their regular crew chief, it is not my right to know about that patient when they come back. I'm sorry. It's not my right. It's to know about the particulars of that patient. We might choose to debrief in general terms, but where they will honor that individual patient's privacy, they may say, "Hey, Steve, this is a very elderly woman. She fell down. We noticed this about her hip," or whatever the call was. Here's how we addressed it. But we guard our patient's privacy jealously and fiercely. So that one of the byproducts of that, Stacey, is that we also associated with that. With our adherence to privacy is we don't do a lot of MIS data mining because we need to be prepared for the breadth of calls that we face. We don't spend a lot of time looking at trends. I'll be more frank, we spend no time looking at trends. If one of us has a call that we find especially interesting, then or we seem to have not been well prepared for, or if anecdotally our operations team notices new calls surface, any trend in the calls, but it would be anecdotally, then we'll make sure that we have redoubled our training in that area. And we do talk about cases on a fully redacted basis. We let enough time go by and we let enough time go by that no one in the room could possibly associate it with an individual. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I can't answer your question specifically, but here's what, I'll tell you what I know that this alliance is clear-minded about. And that is, if it happens anywhere where people get together or live, it happens in the Chathams. And there's nothing to be learned by the expense of the car in the driveway, the diplomas hanging on the walls, that alcoholism and substance and other drug substance abuses afflict every block in our community. I have cared for patients who are either struggling with or dealing with the after effects of substance abuse, or even have been physically assaulted by someone under the impression. I couldn't begin to count it. I don't know, and I go on enough calls that, Stacy, I can tell you, we don't see an obvious trend, right? One of, I'll come back to another thought. We don't see obvious trends other than I personally have cared for opiate overdoses and alcoholism in patients as young as 13. I have attended overdose deaths in Chatham for patients in their 70s. It's not obvious to me that alcoholism amongst any cohort, nor especially the abuse of opiates, is any more pronounced than it was any time in the two decades that I have been taking this job. And I'll say that your statistics and your understanding are better than mine, because you guys are focused on this. Our job as EMTs, sadly, is to be prepared for anywhere on that continuum where alcohol or other recreational or abused prescription drugs will factor with the patient. I know it's not very satisfying. I know that's what the alliance, that's your reason for being together. But there is no obvious trend amongst the people we serve. It's as shocking and as frightening as it always has been. One of the things that is true, you know, I spend an important fraction of my time in a rural community in Vermont. And the thing that makes these two communities different is that people are it's much more public when someone has one of these issues in this little rural town of Vermont. And I'll just note that in Chatham, families have the means or feel it's more important to do more concealing and maybe have, because of the general socioeconomic profile of our communities, and that's it. Of course, the ranges in our community are, it's a complete range. There's a long continuum from people who are impoverished to every now and then somebody who has many, many millions of dollars. It's an overgeneralized statement that it tends to be more concealed. And as a consequence of that, and unless it is absolutely a critical situation, people may be reluctant to dial 911 in favor of seeking what they believe to be a less public solution, not understanding how devoted our squad is to patients' privacy. Your observations, though, again, as it relates to substance abuse, are probably more valuable than mine.
Well, thank you. That was all very helpful. I mean, I do appreciate the protection of people's privacy. I think that's wonderful. But I also, you know, based on what you're saying, my sense is if there really was some dramatic change, you would have noted it because you would have, you know, modified your training or updated your training accordingly. So I guess I take comfort in both of those responses.
I'll say that substance abuse is overrepresented in our overall patient responses because substance abusers and alcoholics tend to be repeat patients, right? So we may see the same alcoholic, or we may see the same substance abuser more, you know, quite frequently. We could see them as many as 7 to 10 times in a year. I will say that I have responded to an opiate overdose. I've done it. I've responded in general to more than I would like. I would have liked to, but on one occasion we used. We had the same patient twice. Both were Narcan resuscitations, or we applied Narcan. That has been a rarity in our experience. But as you again probably know better than I, that Narcan is likely to have to be readministered to the same patient on a different day because of the horror of addiction.
Steve, can I ask a question about Narcan? So we've had some different Narcan trainings offered throughout the years, and something that came up at one point was the discrepancy between the Narcan that you administer, that an emergency squad or an EMT would administer, versus what a police officer would administer. In that case, if you respond to a call where Narcan has to be deployed, who is administering it, and is it based on the different types that you both have?
So the naloxone, so the actual pharmacological agent that is used by, that is carried by our patrolmen and that we carry on our ambulances, are identical.
Okay.
Absolutely identical. It's the same receptor antagonist. And what is different, potentially, is simply the delivery device. The total dose carried in the vial, and whether or not it will go up a single nostril. Let me go back a half step if I could. I talked about that the squad is certified, that EMTs, not the squad, EMTs are certified by the state. And it was, I think you guys again know better than I, 2013, the legislature acted, and over a period of time, the state allowed EMS organizations like ours, for the individual EMTs who are properly trained, to administer our own prescribed doses of Narcan. That happens under the auspices of our medical director, who happens to be an employee of Atlantic Health. So Dr. Ritter adapted the state protocols to become Atlantic Health protocols, and we are duty bound to the extent we use a prescription that was made to the squad. We're duty bound to follow his protocols. And it just so happens that our device, half the dose goes in one nostril, half the dose goes in the other nostril. We have been very harmonized with our two police departments over time, but for various reasons, like manufacturers providing the police department free doses or low cost doses, or some initiative out of the Attorney General's office, they may start to carry a different device, but the mechanism is the same. It will just vary, one, how you put the capsule into the atomizer and what share of the dose goes in one nostril and one in the other. It can be a hint more complicated for a professional rescuer like us than we would want it to be for a patrol person. But truth be told, I don't think that the squad, the number of times that the squad has used its prescribed dose on an overdose patient is very rare. Why? Because the patrol person probably beat us there and reached for their Narcan and gave that first dose. So the overwhelming majority of Narcan administration patients that the squad sees, that first dose was administered by the patrol officer. To my knowledge, actually, I'm aware of a single incident where a layperson, meaning a family member or a friend of the patient, had administered the first dose, but that is, it's a thing now, as you know, because of the much more generalized availability of Narcan in the community. And hopefully, you know, we're on this constant path of deteriorating the stigma associated with being friends with, caring for folks who have opiate addictions. And we're gonna save more lives than ever before. So we have seen all manner of range of death I mentioned before amongst opiate overdoses, from both based on age, both based on repeat patient and outcomes. Our naloxone is wonderfully effective when it's administered, but we have clearly attended opiate deaths. Is that okay, Allison? You were
there. Yeah, definitely. And I want, just to your point too about going to a call where somebody had administered, somebody other than you or law enforcement had administered the Narcan. The past, I think, two trainings that I've been to over the past few years, there have been parents of people struggling with opioid use disorder in the training that were there to go through the training and to receive the Narcan themselves, so that, as a preventative measure. So that's definitely something that I've noticed in the trainings that I've been to over the past few years.
And of course, the opioid abuse that we see comes in different forms. We have been to the almost metaphorical patient down with a needle extended from the arm to folks who abused prescriptions written to them for legitimate purpose. So it's obvious, as I said before, if it happens on God's earth, it happens in Chatham.
Steve, do you guys respond to mental health emergencies, or does there have to be that medical component for you to respond?
No, we are trained for and respond to, our quote medical training includes psychiatric and emotional disease, trauma, illness. We respond to anything someone dials 911 for and the dispatcher believes is medical related, whether it is traumatic, whether it is illness, but clearly, Stacy, a high fraction of our calls are psychiatric and have a psychiatric underlying to them. It is a very high fraction of the calls we attend. And of course, they don't happen in isolation from other medical conditions, and folks who are struggling emotionally or psychologically may not be accessing or provided medical care. So you find them as in situ together, those kind, but it's alarming. And that, knows no bounds of, knows no socioeconomic bounds, no age bounds, no race bounds. We attend that quite frequently. What does that have in common with our people who have a substance abuse disorder? And that is they tend to be repeated patients because I won't soapbox this because I imagine it's what you folks, when you're together, this is what you're wringing your hands over, is that there just are not sufficient social interventions. So if we take you in because you've been violent with a family member, or you're hallucinating, or you are abusing alcohol, we're highly likely to see you again, because the only intervention that we have is to stabilize you and take you to a hospital. And what I have learned over time is that the tools at the hospital are very, very limited. There's not much capacity. There's not much that a hospital can do once a person is sober and returned to their self-capacity to keep them there. the available social interventions provided at the municipal, which is to say really at the Morris County level, are very spare. And so we are not social workers, but it is absolutely heartbreaking when we attend a patient and we know we're going to see them again. And we, unless we are duty bound by state law and the responsibilities we have as medical providers to deal with instances of abuse or criminal neglect. There, we have some mandatory reporting requirements, but it has to almost rise to that level for us to even be, well, it does have to rise to that level for us to even be able to whistle in a governmental intervention. It's prescribed that we do it, but how we do it and what scope we have with that is also very prescribed, very, very frustrating. Even though we have a limited scope of practice, which is to protect life, stabilize and transport to definitive care, which is a fancy way of saying overlook a Morristown hospital, we're heartbroken at what we're not equipped in to do. And the fact that we're absent good solutions to point people at. But I know that's what you folks are here together to think about. But that's what substance abuse and psychiatric disorders have in common.
Thanks, Steve. Excuse me. Does anyone have any other questions for Steve? You shared so much really interesting information, stuff that I feel like a lot of times we have, you know, I've heard from some people in the community that they don't think that substance use is an issue, especially opioids, that they don't think that it's in Chatham or Madison. And that's why it's so important, you know, for people to hear from you that it is here. And, you know, like what you said about happening on every block. I think that that's so important to note because, you know, it doesn't discriminate. So that was a really valuable point also.
But Steve also touched on what we had been talking for years about is the stigma and in the community and just sort of, you know, not talking about mental or, you know, these type things, you know. And he laid a great foundation on even when they stabilize and bring somebody to the hospital, there are not the resources. And I think, you know, people who may have gone through the system realize that. And I think it's a cycle of the help out there isn't what it seems. Or navigating the whole system, I think is, not easy. So, you know, but it's something in my throat. So, but I think, Steve, you really laid out that foundation of, the social interventions and social services are not there in the way that they really should, much like the other medical interventions are there. You know, and are navigated till you feel better or you get to a certain point, you know, less so with you know, addiction. So.
Marilyn put a question in the chat about materials, if the coalition provides materials to the emergency squad, and we don't, you know, that's something, Steve, that we certainly would be able to do if, you know, if you think that there would be a need for it. So we have a lot of different materials. We have a substance abuse resource directory that we share at all of our, you know, whenever we're tabling. It has, straight here, it just has, and I'll send this to you, but it just has a lot of different emergency hotlines, detox services, adolescent inpatient, outpatient services. So we give these to law enforcement in both communities as well. So that's something that we can definitely share with you for you guys to have if you think that that you'd be able to use those. The other thing that we're working
Let me interrupt for just a second. The answer is we would like to have those, but we would not give those to families in real time. And here's why. One, we're in a complicated situation. If we happen to have, if we happen to deploy Narcan, one of the things, one of the good news is that the patient is probably alive. It is a struggle to get someone. When we use Narcan, our patients do not believe that they were not breathing 3 minutes earlier. They just don't believe it, and they don't want any part of us. And because there's a police officer there, what they want is us out of their home as quick as they can get us out of their home. And so our first order of business and our first battle is to convince the patient that they need to go to the hospital because they really were more dead than alive a couple minutes before. The other is that we have a defined role in all of this. And what we actually have to do, what I found myself as a leader having to do, is tamp down people's desire, tamp down our members' desire to not become social workers, but to talk about treatment, to talk about what might be next. And why should we not do that, even if we're very knowledgeable about it? Because our job is to get that patient to someone who is an expert in that field. And we don't want to do anything that contradicts or distracts from what the hopefully the trained physician at the emergency room is going to do. We would never be appropriately and fully trained to be interveners, is that the right noun, in a situation like that. But I do know that everyone on the squad would like themselves to be more aware. You know, there's 90 of us, and if we all have three friends, then now we're starting to capture a percentage of the population. So that would be very useful, but probably not something we would address in real time with the family unless we were asked to see, yeah, there are resources and let me go get them for you.
The other thing that that we, knowing that you, you know, that you have prescription Narcan that you use, something that came up was also the plunger trainer devices. So when we, the last time that we offered a Narcan training, this was a couple of years ago now, we did it through the through Rutgers, and somebody that went through that training had let us know that their Narcan had expired and kind of what should they do with it. So we were able to reach out to Rutgers, and they actually sent, I think, 20 new doses to replace those ones that had expired. And we had asked about potentially, you know, can we hang on to those, to the expired Narcan as training devices? And, you know, obviously the answer is no, we don't, you know, you don't want Narcan that was expired circulating. But what they did best was to reach out to Adapt Pharma, who's the manufacturer, to request trainer plungers. So they reset each time. You can use them multiple times just to get a feel for what it's like to have to use it. So we have those on order. We actually had them sent to the wrong address a couple of weeks ago. We're waiting for those to come back to us, and then we will share those with anybody, you know, that would like to have them. So that's another thing that we can share when we get them.
Very good. We for the specific delivery mechanism that we have, we do have trainers in the those, because as I mentioned, we carry naloxone on our ambulances under our medical direction of Atlantic Health. We are required to train specifically on Narcan every year.
Great.
Amongst other, especially medication related mm-hmm. protocols.
Does anybody else have any questions or comments or anything for Steve? It was so valuable, really, Steve. Thank you so much.
I'm really glad to make a contribution. And I know that we're supposed to talk with each other about what might we do for you and you do for us. So here's my ask, is that the broad strokes about the way emergency medical services is organized in the Chathams and Madison is that we are all volunteer. I know in Madison, there are, in some very limited circumstances, they have paid per diem staff. And we do not charge for our services. And so we are volunteer dependent. And so to the extent you find yourselves in conversations as people who are personally invested in the health and emotional welfare of the community, just tell that story, because you can't volunteer for something you don't know as a volunteer organization.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for including us, Allison.
Thank you, Steve. We really appreciate it. And we look forward to continuing the conversation as we go.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Yeah, very, very good.
Okay, we have about 20 minutes left, so a lot of stuff to go over. So I'll just keep going through my quick updates, and then Lisa is going to share some from our cannabis task force meeting, and Nixie's going to share a little bit about community engagement. So I was talking about the teen task force. We are working to also have one representative from the teen task force join us for our meetings. Going forward, that might mean we had Natalia came on. Natalia, she goes by Nate. She's one of our new teen task force members. So we might have to change our meeting time every once in a while to accommodate their schedules, their school schedules. But we're looking to have them, you know, going back to what I was saying about having it be totally teen driven. They will be, instead of me updating the coalition on what the teen task force is doing, they will start to do that. Hopefully at the next meeting. So we're going to be meeting every 2 weeks. We had our first meeting last week. We're meeting again next week. And we're just really excited. They have a lot of really good ideas. They are charged right now with recruitment, and we're doing some different social media strategies around recruitment. And by the time, and they all were very interested in that. By the time I got home from our meeting last week, we had two more people reach out looking to join. So they are definitely the ones to do the recruitment, which is great. We're really excited about that. Some other updates. We have Detective Shannon will be doing his drug trends training. Again, the last time that we worked together and got that training out was at the Elk in March, early March 2020. So we'll be bringing it back. It's going to be held at the Madison Community House on October 20th. I think the time is 7:00. So we're looking forward to that. Detective Shannon is going to be updating his presentation because it's been so long. So there's a lot of substances that he wants to add, some stuff that he wants to remove. So we are looking forward to that. And we're also very grateful that the Community House is going to host it at their location. And then also that they're going to be sharing it with their population. So we'll be getting the word out to hopefully get a lot of people in attendance, which is going to be great. I mentioned at our last meeting, we're bringing back Hidden in Plain Sight. That we haven't locked in a date yet. We're waiting to hear back from schools on back to school nights in Madison and Chatham, but we're looking at the second half of September. Again, that's going to be in person, hopefully either at the junior school or the high school in Madison. We're bringing DEA agent Tim McMahon back. We're going to be working with MASA and MCC, or excuse me, MASA and MAC to have lots of different resources. Detective Shannon will be there as well to talk about local conditions for that presentation, which is great. And we'll be reaching out to Chatham Borough and Chatham Township law enforcement to see if they'd like to participate as well. So once we have the date and location finalized, we will get that out. Also, I mentioned at our last meeting, we are looking to bring in Legal One, which is a presentation that will focus on cannabis legalization. So title of the presentation is Marijuana Legalization, Cannabis Policy Implications for Communities. So when Lisa talked about the Cannabis Task Force meeting, one of the things that came out of that was trying to get a training for our key stakeholders in our community, really focusing on local government, schools, law enforcement, youth serving organizations, and then also of course coalition members, but not necessarily making this presentation open to everyone in the community, really focusing on those key stakeholders and the issues that they might, that they find themselves dealing with around legalization. So we have a date, August 31st at 5 p.m. It's going to be a virtual presentation. And David Nash and John Worthington will be the presenters. And the topics are really gonna be the key considerations for municipalities. You know, things that they're gonna deal with, how towns can best use the 5-year opt-out moratorium to use that to their advantage so that they're better poised once the 5 years are up. We're gonna start creating the flyers for or the artwork for that and get that out in the next week or so. So we're very excited about that. What else? Oh, one other training opportunity. As you know, we have for the past 2 years, we've worked with Tracy Johnson and Carl Alves from TTJ to do some technical assistance training for the coalition. We are looking at bringing them back hopefully in September, maybe October, to focus on another aspect of technical assistance for the coalition. So, you know, we're coming into our last of 5 years. So we really have to focus on our community needs assessment. Some other topics that we could focus on are engaging the faith-based community, things like that. So I have a preliminary call with them next week to talk about different options for our coalition for TA. So we'll have more about that at our next meeting. I think that that's all that I have. Nixie, do you want to talk about community engagement before we go to Lisa?
So I just want to give a quick recap of our sticker shot campaign that we did. We collaborated with MAC and we went out to the community to 4 liquor stores in Chatham. So we visited Bottle King, Cottage Deli, Hickory Wine Cellars, and USA Wine Traders. The press release has officially been published on TAP and the Courier as well. So I do just want to thank all those who came out and did participate in helping us, you know, with yet another successful campaign. I will be passing by the liquor stores this week just to kind of, you know, acknowledge the store owners or the managers who allowed us to come in. And as some of you may know, we've been putting out on the newsletter for signups for Madison Farmers Market. We're there twice a month on Thursdays between 1 to 6. We will now be providing a community survey at the farmers market. And it's super accessible. You can scan a QR code and we just ask questions like we do in the student survey, like such as how teens are accessing different substances. We have questions for both parents and the teens. Since we weren't able to be in person at schools during this past school year, it is very important to collect this information. And since it is a QR code, it does make it easier for us to bring them to our events in the future as we continue doing tabling events. And we are all set and confirmed also for National Night Out on August 3rd. So it is gonna be at 3 locations. We're looking at Chatham Township. It'll be from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Colony Pool and then at Chatham Borough from also 5 to 8 at Memorial Park in Chatham. And for Madison, it'll be from 5 to 8, they're all the same time. For Madison, it is at the Waverly Place. I really want to, you know, encourage you all to please, if you know someone or yourself, if you're interested in volunteering, to come out and spread the word for both Farmers Market and National Night Out. You can find the sign-up sheet for the Farmers Market on our Instagram or on our newsletters that have been going out weekly on Thursdays. After today, you'll also be finding a sign-up sheet for National Night Out. We don't ask that you stay the entire shift. You know, any amount of help is greatly appreciated. And it is a great way to give back to the community and kind of network and get together again now that things are opening up and, you know, going semi back to normal. So I really do encourage that. We do need a lot of more people to come out. Again, there's going to be time slots and it'll be split. If you think that maybe the time slot's too long, you know, you can email myself or Allison. You definitely don't have to stay the full hour or 2 hours. Even, you know, a few minutes, you know, half an hour of your day would really help us out.
I would very much like to encourage our membership to please come out to the farmers market. We do it every other week. I've been the only one that's been there. And it would be really nice if we could get other people to join us. I'm telling you, it's not that hard and it's great. You're outside, it's in the farmers market. Come on, let's go.
Thanks, yes, John. Thank you to John for stepping up the past few farmers markets. It's just nice to have somebody else there. And John knows everybody, so he brings everybody to the table. So that's great. And I also want to mention too, with National Night Out, we will be sharing a table with Project Community Pride. It'll be mental health resources as well as substance abuse prevention. So we have giveaways, you know, fun stuff like that. And it's a fun night, and it'll be even more fun this year, having had to take last year off. But, you know, obviously Nixie and I are two people. We have three towns that we're trying to hit with Christine and her limited staff as well. So whatever help that you can give for that night as well. We're also going to have the, I think the Teen Task Force members are going to be coming out as well. So it'll be a great opportunity to meet them. So, all right. Thanks, Nixie. And then the last part of our meeting today, I'll turn it over to Lisa DeRosa to talk about our cannabis task force.
Okay. Real quickly, we met last month, Allison, representing MCC, Stacy for the township, Len for the borough, and we missed John, but he's included in this also. So the mission of the task force is, now that the towns have opted out, now what? With our communities and the recreational marijuana legislation. So, and especially with MCC, you know, the 12 to 17 year olds and, you know, policy and prevention and how we approach marijuana in the era of, you know, legalized, the legalization. So we discussed, what is in the bill. I think more questions came up in the task force of, what's ahead? What is the role of law enforcement? There's been changes. We don't know what's in the bill. School policies, how will that change? So we discussed more education and engagement in the community. We discussed the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, which they establish and regulate medical and personal use cannabis. And I've been following them online, and their last meeting was June that they posted the minutes. The last meeting was July 13th, but the minutes that they posted were for June. I was looking at them. And what I noticed is just in the public comment, it was basically a lot of the public who, want to have a stake in having cannabis businesses. And I was also struck, there doesn't seem to be a lot of engagement in the state as a whole, or even know about this regulatory commission. I would just note that the mayor of Clinton, who's the president of the New Jersey League of Municipalities, and as Allison said, the league has not taken a position on legalized, but municipalities are delaying decisions until they know all the rules. Mayor Kovach gave recommendations that municipalities be given local control and discretion, as well as the ability to revoke a license if needed. Municipalities should have the ability to set requirements regarding odor control, health and safety, and site locations. So she's saying what we're saying, you know, now what? What's, you know, so gathering data to sort of, you know, see where this goes. But as it applies to 12 to the 17 year olds that we are, you know, targeting, I think we have to look at schools, law enforcement policy, and then some other things where the edibles, you know, what's that going to look like? And then the education on edible zoning ordinances, quality control. And I will note there's six classes of cannabis businesses that, you know, if you're going to do zoning, you have to, it's cultivation, manufacturing, preparing, packaging, wholesaling, and transportation. So those are all in there also. So as I said, there's more questions, but I think the cannabis having this kind of looking forward type thing and starting to educate and engaging is better than all of a sudden 5 years up and then having to really, you know, you know, then people become aware. So I think, you know, so that would be my thing right there.
Thanks, Lisa. Some of the other things that came out of that meeting, we kind of are focused on, like I said, the key stakeholders. So we are going to be inviting law enforcement to this next meeting. I think we've scheduled a date. I have to look back to see if we actually landed on July 27th for that meeting. But the goal is to bring a different sector in for each meeting to sort of hear what their, you know, what their concerns are, what their areas of focus are, and what we can do as a task force or as a committee to help get those resources to them. So that's one of the great things about this presentation from David Nash. He, you know, when I had my preliminary call with him, one of the things that we talked about was loopholes. You know, just in our preliminary conversation with Stacy and Len, you know, people are, you know, rightly so, people are concerned about how to manage the potential loopholes with the bill. So things like gifting and testing facilities and things like that. So David Nash will be able to answer those questions and to provide some insight, which is so great. And we imagine that law enforcement, these other key stakeholders that we're going to be engaging are going to have questions as well. And hopefully we'll be able to compile those prior to David's presentation. He actually asked that we get those to him ahead of time so that he can speak to all of those issues. So that'll be something also. One other thing that came out of that meeting was potentially doing an FAQ that we would have available to residents in Madison and Chatham that would kind of go through like key things that residents need to know about cannabis legalization. So things like what opt-out means, like Lisa said, the different classes, you know, just keeping it very factual. But as a coalition, since we are focused on prevention of use in 12 to 17 year olds, we would also have to include something about, you know, the negative effects associated with, you know, for teens. So we'd want that as well, but it would not be the focus of the document. So we're working on that. I'm working on that. That will definitely be done before our next meeting, which is, I think, it's a week from today. So we'll review that. That'll be one of our agenda items for that. And then going forward, we will, you know, somebody from our committee hopefully will be able to report back to the coalition for our monthly meetings to kind of share where we are and what developments we've had. I think that's it. Stacy, anything that you want to add from that meeting?
No, I covered everything. The only thing I had, oops, of course now it rings. sorry about that.
Call from Savitri Baskin.
Sorry, it's going to pick up in a minute, the machine. Hopefully you can hear me over that. The only thing I wanted to add is the township did pass the ordinance where we kind of bolstered our opt-out ordinance with some police regulation updates. So that I had shared a copy of that if any of the other towns are interested in seeing that, and it is finalized.
Hello, this is Save a Tree calling with a message from the
can't hear my messages and everything.
Yes,
Save a tree, Stacy. Save a tree.
We have perfect timing. Not a classic. I don't talk most of the time, but when I talk, then all of a sudden the machine picks up.
All right. Thanks, Stacy. Just one last thing real quick that came up. And I just want to throw it out there because I said I would, you know, I want to follow up with this person. I had somebody reach out to me a couple of weeks ago now because she had seen the parents who host Lose the Most signs in Chatham. She lives in the township. And she had reached out because she was asking for a sign for herself, for her personal property. So I returned her call, obviously. And, you know, I let her know that I could get the sign to her. And she let, you know, we got into a conversation and she let me know that her neighborhood had a house that was consistently hosting underage parties. Parents were home and, you know, they were aware of what was going on. And, you know, she had been in touch with law enforcement and the response from law enforcement was that there wasn't that much that could be done because of private property ordinances. And, you know, she just felt very conflicted about what to do. And she kind of felt, you know, she has young children, she has a child that's going into the middle school and she's not the only one in her neighborhood that feels that it's not right, that this is happening and that not much can be done. So, you know, and we talked about, you know, she brought up an issue where there was a house party that had been broken up in the township earlier this year, or maybe it was late last year. And, you know, she didn't understand why that information was publicized and why, you know, law enforcement was able to go in and break that party up. And we had a conversation about COVID restrictions and how the bigger issue in that situation was that the house most likely was breaking COVID restrictions. So, you know, we talked about what more could be done. And, you know, we talked about law enforcement and how what she's felt her response, the response from law enforcement has been. And we kind of got to a point where there wasn't really much else that could be said. You know, I let her know that we've had conversations with law enforcement when we do our key informant interviews, when we did one a year and a half ago now. And they did talk about the private property ordinances and how, you know, it really, they feel that it there isn't anything that they can do because they're bound, obviously, you know, if there's an ordinance that they can't go on to private property. So, you know, I told her that I wanted to bring it up at the coalition meeting just to talk. I also let her know that we're going to be doing more key informant interviews in the next 2 months with law enforcement and that this would be something that I would bring, obviously totally anonymous but and confidential, but I would bring up in the key informant interview because I've heard the same situation happen in Chatham Borough in a specific neighborhood. And just to sort of talk it out with law enforcement a little bit and learn more about the ordinances and if there is anything else that somebody in a community, you know, a homeowner can do, if there's more that we can be doing as a coalition, if there's more that can be done, you know, by local government or anything. But, you know, I'm going to be following up with her next week to let her know that we talked about it. But does anybody have any input or any other suggestions to add to this conversation? I also will mention she, I got back to her and asked how she heard about the coalition or how she knew to reach out. And she actually said that she saw the letter to the editor that was published by our teen task force about social hosting. So, I mean, so it reached somebody, which is great. But yeah, anybody have anything to add to the conversation?
Did you get a sense that this is a regular occurrence of obviously more than like a party situation on a regular basis because it's sort of we could drink there type thing? Because I really think that type of thing should be talked to the police about, like what can be done with that situation, especially over the summer. I feel for her. She seemed to be somebody who's trying to sort of reach out if she reached out, but just at her wit's end, you know. So it seems like a real gathering party kind of thing, which is a difficult thing. Yeah, that's a, you know, years ago when the coalition started, this was a conversation on the police wanting to do something and just, you know, not being able to just in these kind of situations, which is unfortunate, I think.
Yeah.
From my point of view. So did you get a sense that they were also like late night type things as well?
I mean, she said that they're the only action that she could take was, or law enforcement could take, was if there was a noise violation. So they definitely were able to, you know, they used that to their advantage at times. You know, I will say too, with our conversation, I think that she had, you know, she felt a certain way about law enforcement's, you know, kind of what they were doing or what they were not doing. And when she brought up the house party that had been broken up in the township several months ago, I took that opportunity to, just knowing the law enforcement that we work with and knowing that we've had these conversations before, you know, voicing my opinion that COVID allowed law enforcement the opportunity to get into that house to break that party up, where they haven't had that opportunity in other circumstances. So sort of that it gave them the opportunity to capitalize on, to get into that house or onto that property because there were the COVID restrictions, and that got them there. And then they used that to their advantage to also break up the party where underage drinking was happening. So
did you get a sense of there were people driving there? There were cars.
Parents dropping kids off.
Parents were dropping kids off?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah. I had heard a similar story, and I don't know if it's the same. It happened to be on Green Village Road, but the gentleman expressed interest in you know, MCC and MAC had told us he's a volunteer firefighter, and they were coming back from a call at about 1 a.m., this big fire truck on Green Village Road. And he said there were like 40 kids intoxicated, rambling on the road, you know, who clearly had been drinking. And it was just a dangerous situation to navigate, not to mention the kids had been drinking. So,
right.
You know, he was very concerned. And same thing, you know, the tough part is I remember way back when in the MAC meetings, the police officers talking about private property rules just made it very difficult for them to do anything. And then, you know, like you said, Allison, that, you know, if they could approach from a noise or some other issue, but it was very hard for them to do anything. And now you layer on top of the penalties related to the marijuana, which I understand is going to apply to alcohol for officers, and it just makes them much harder. So they're trying to work to figure that piece out. But that's the part that I want to understand where we are, and I just don't have that information, is that the regulations that are being developed and what the police are allowed to do and not allowed to do. And I understand that they're trying to avoid discriminatory practices, but, you know, at the same time, if we don't have any ability to follow through when there's underage, you know, drinking and drug use on private property, you know, it's just, I'm worried there's going to be big problems down the road.
Yeah.
And these kids, you know, when they figure it out, which they do, you know, they're pretty entitled. I mean, they will just do what they want and, you know, duck the, they'll know the rules and they'll know how to duck any penalties for what they're doing. So I do like the idea of parents who host, you know, signage on private property, if that's something we would, you know, make available to residents, if there's just a campaign to, as part of that campaign, that people can get a free sign to put on their lawn.
Maybe also as a neighbor, sort of a message of I care, in other words, I care, you know, with that message or another message, just kind of a subtle, I care, you know, sort of getting something like that over if you're going to put the sign as a neighbor, like first saying I care.
Yeah.
You know, my intention is that I care.
Yeah, I think the Parents Who Host Lose the Most campaign has been around forever, and even just rebrand, like, you know, if the coalition was to take something like that on and rebrand it a little bit, change the messaging.
With,
broader.
but just that kind of simple, you know, just in that caring way.
Yeah.
You know, it's a difficult situation. It's always been those parents who, having a daughter who, would go to those parties, for me, it was, I can't believe, somebody, I'd go pick her up at 1 o'clock because I didn't know where she was. I had to track her down, but those were those homes, So anyway, but I think it's worth the discussion and worth kind of, if a member of the community, really, she reached out for that reason. I think that's, and she's probably not the only one.
No, she's not. And I let her know that. So I think it's, it's a responsibility of ours to.
And as Stacy said, with the legalization and the, the role of police uncertain, where we could depend on certain things maybe years ago, on a certain level, it's not going to be, a lot of tools are going to be taken away.
Yeah.
In that way. So I think it's worth, actually, when we meet with the police, that would be a good task force, just a, an agenda item. That would be a good discussion item. Ways that maybe they've seen other municipalities and police forces deal with this, I think engaging the community more, not on social media, but just kind of, other connections with people.
So I want to emphasize what Lisa is saying. I think that having a positive message like I care about underage alcohol and drug use, I think, would be a better sign than, I really don't like this parents who host lose the most sign. It's very negative. It talks about punishment. And I don't think our goal should be punishment. I think our goal should be taking care of our young people and having them grow up without these dependencies. And so I really like Lisa's idea of creating a positive sign and making that sign available for anybody in the community. I think having those signs like that up, I have two signs already on my property about love and stopping Asian hate. I think that being a positive message, I care about underage drinking and substance abuse, I think sends a much more positive message. And it gets the ability to have a sign on a variety of neighborhood streets makes the message a lot stronger. I think that's something we can do. I'm a little concerned about this, about the reaction of all the municipalities about marijuana usage and everybody saying, well, not in my neighborhood, because that means you don't have any control over it. And I'm really concerned about the fact that, yes, I understand municipalities are trying to understand the rules and regulations, but I do think also the idea about legalization was to be able to have control so that people are not going out and buying this stuff on the street that you have no idea what's in it and has fentanyl and things like that in it. So I think we really have to not make it the big boogeyman situation because we already have people out there abusing alcohol. And I think it just becomes another one of those substances that is not healthy as an addiction. And I think that's what our message really should be. I care. I really like that, Lisa. Thank you.
Normally, and certainly all the years with our character education programs, for the kids, the focus was positive messaging. It depends what our goal is, because in this case, the households that are hosting, two that I've known over the years, they're baked in there in terms of what. So the only thing that would work at this point is punitive kind of fear, fear that the understanding, or for other people who are going down that road, the understanding that they can be, fined, or they could be arrested, or, I think there was a gentleman who was arrested for hosting a party over here on Fairmount. I think it was a COVID violation, but there was definitely alcohol and drugs. I remember reading that. And I thought that would have more of an impact on the people considering doing it than anything else. So, you know, I guess it depends on what the goal of the campaign is. And I get where you're coming from. I just don't know that it'll have much of an impact on the people that are hosting these events.
Well, those who host Lose the Most came from because there was a lot of situations years and years and years ago. I mean, that was the whole.
I think it was in response to
getting in cars. I think the proms, the graduation, it just was a lot happening. I'm almost saying put the I care with the reality of, you know, the two messages, you know.
Yeah. And even like Parents Who Host Lose the Most campaign comes from, it came from a coalition in Ohio. And I think that even just like the look of, you know, some of the artwork and everything, I think it could just be updated so that it's
rebranding.
More rebranding. And so that it's specific to our community also. I think that that goes a long way. But
we can almost have the youth, maybe somebody at the high school or middle school can come up with, or the task force, artwork and some sort of, sign.
I was gonna suggest maybe that's something that we bring to the teen task force for suggestions, and Project Community Pride also.
Maybe we could have an art contest downtown where somebody picks the sign they like the most.
Yeah, or at least some focus groups to look at potential signage.
Something that engages there again. In that simple way, you know. So
All right. Well, it's 10 after, so I won't keep everybody any longer. Thank you all for hanging on until the very end.
It was really good. Steve was great. That was a great.
Very interesting.
It is what people do in the community. It's what you think you know and what you don't know.
Right.
You know, that was really, really good. So thank you for that. You know.
And we hope to have a great presentation for the combined meeting in August. So more details will be coming out about that. But thank you all so much. And
hi, everybody. We'll see
you next month.
All right. Thank you
so much.
Bye, Rosella.
Thank you. Have a good day,
everybody.
Bye.